Coming up right after our little chat here, you have a piece about a Croatian artist.
It seems to be all Croatia week. It's on what was it, Sunday? I saw the Croatian national folklore dance troupe called Lado, and it was absolutely amazing and wonderful. And now we have this part one of this interview that I did with Kat Cork, who is a Croatian Canadian artist and HIV AIDS activist.
Great. Well, I look forward to hearing that in a few minutes. Joining us also in studio is Jeffrey Mackey. Jeffrey, is your mic on?
Is it on?
It's coming on for sure. Okay. Thanks for coming in. How was your ride in this morning, or your voyage in?
I took the metro. It takes me about 25 minutes. And I also have a guest this morning of Croatian background, Josip Novaković. And he's an author, novelist, short story writer. And he's currently teaching at Concordia.
And he'll be actually coming into the studio.
Yeah, does anybody know what the Croatian national anthem sounds like?
Well, no, I don't.
We might be able to call that up on YouTube. Also, in between the two Croatians, I'll be interviewing Sonia Lukowski, who was at the Bush shoe throwing rally in front of the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. She's part of the Montreal
Hotel.
9/11.
Hotel.
The place where John Lennon and Yoko Ono did their Imagine Peace in. So George Bush came and did his war in, I suppose. So she'll be talking about her experiences there. She's actually part of the Montreal 9/11 Truth Movement, to which I have some sympathies. And so we'll be having a far-field conversation. So let's see. It's already 7:08. We better get to it. First up is a Croat piece.
Kat Korak.
So give us the little one-minute intro, if you please.
There, Kat Korak came here back in, what was it, the early 70s, I think, like most of the Croatian diaspora. And she is an artist, AIDS activist, woman about town, and really, really likes house music. I was most pleased to be able to find some Croatian house music to play in the background.
All right, so this is going to go for about 15 minutes, and we'll see you on the other side. Enjoy.
Cheers. Thank you. Appreciate it big time.
My pleasure.
I love it.
Slagat ćeš ako mi kažeš da nisam te ni sa kim dijelila. I ko da zna, da li jedna ljubav traje do vijeka. Odnosiš prašnjavim poperom.
That kind of stuff happens all the time. It depends on what the media wants to pick up and promote. It depends on what the arch powers, the editors, the night before when they get together and sit down and shoot what's going to be the front page story. I always wonder about that, what makes it the front page news and why? And is it a plan, They do. They sit around talking to decide what's going to be on the news. But don't you think they leak certain stories on purpose to divert your attention from what's really going on? And there's certain stories they sit on and they go, let's leak this now. You don't think there's the powers that be that get together and decide we're going to leak this tomorrow because we want to divert attention from this political thing, in terms of ruling the world, how stories get leaked to the media. Don't you think it's strategically leaked? So what do you think of the whole Michael Jackson thing? I felt bad because the guy was so damn talented, such a good dancer, singer, my God, writer. Never would have expected that to happen. And it was sad to see how much they jumped on that whole drug bandwagon, right away. I remember when Elvis died, my dad had tears in his eyes, and he looked at me, and there was an Elvis movie on TV, and he said, he died today. And I remember that I was a little kid, and I saw my dad with tears in his eyes, and I was like, oh, Dad's crying, what's going on? And Elvis died. I remember when John Lennon died. It was a rainy day, and I was going to school, grade school, and I remember they said, or maybe early high school, they said, John Lennon died today, and they played one of his songs. It was raining. It was so sad. I was so depressed, because he was great. I guess every time one of those big stars dies, just makes an impact on you. Like when Kurt Cobain died, that was huge. That was sad, It was a show, the guy was a showman, I felt bad when I found out how much painkillers he was on, and he's been on these
heavy-duty painkillers for all his life after the hair-burning incident. And you think of Elvis, like, he had to take uppers to get up and downers to go to sleep, and if he wanted to go take his kids to an amusement park, he had to rent the park at night, so obviously. Judy Garland, same shit. She'd take all these pills so she could stay up and sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow 100 million times all over the place. You know, no wonder, you know? Oh, that would have been hot. There's a lot of these places, like, you know, if you go, like, on the plateau in between, like, Saint Laurent, Saint Denis, below Mount Royal, above Rachel, like, that whole pocket, there's those little places that only seat, like, 10 and less, and they usually bring your own wine, and they look so good, because they're always full, and it's always the neighborhood that knows about it. It's like a little secret place. Oh, man, I want to go to all those. There's a lot of those little good ones, you know, they're tiny, and they're not really advertise, but the people who know, they know it's good to go there, you know, and they have these special, and whatever the cook makes for that night, that's what's that night, and if there's no more, you know, I like that. And you can even bring your own wine glasses, like, for some of them, if you like to have your big ballon, you know. See, I'm one of those people, I cook, and the worst thing I hate is, like, when you try a new restaurant and it's not good, and you're like, oh, man, you know. I'm always weary about trying new places, and lately I've been becoming more like daring, you know, like trying new stuff. Oh, there's gonna be a party for that when that happens, for sure. It's amazing, like, when you think of the fans that love the DJ, you know, they love that DJ so much. Like, put yourself in the feet of the DJ, you know, it's like, it's all about the fans, you know, hopefully. It's like amazing the life they lead, you know, and like, I don't know if they know how much of a, I think they do know, actually, that so many fans have such a personal connection with the DJ, you know, and if the DJ talks to them, it's like they just made their life, you know, and it's like everything's about the DJ, you know. There's some fans follow the DJ, like, all around the country, you know, and they just go to this certain DJ, you know. There's some fans that are like fanatics for like one DJ, you know, like Tiesto. When Tiesto comes, the people just stand there and stare at him, and it's funny to see, like, a crowd watching a Tiesto show. Nobody's moving. They're all standing in an oval around the DJ, and they're just like staring at him.
Doesn't sound like DJ.
No, he's good.
He's got nobody dancing.
They're dancing, but they're kind of aiming at him.
Okay.
You know, and he's like the god. You know, and it's like they're all like around the DJ, and he's like radiating from the middle, and he's like putting the music out, and they're all around. Like, you know, it's like he's got this aura of fans. It's really cool. But music, once again, like painting, it's a communicator.
Mm-hmm.
It joins people together. There's nothing better than hearing a really kick-ass song in a club and looking in the eye of somebody who's dancing, and you're like, yeah, you know? And you got your arms in the air, and you look at each other, and you nod, and you're like, yeah, you know? It's a good feeling. Like, life is hard enough, you know? Thank God for music, you know? Like, I love that feeling music can give you, and sometimes at home, I blast the music. There's certain songs that can, oh my God, you know? They can just take you to a whole nother level. And I'm not talking about just house music. Like, I'll put on, like, Rhapsody in Blue by Gershwin. And that inspires me to, like, levels, you know? It's amazing how music can really make you feel, you know, really good. I love that about music. So I think when you get, and don't forget, people have been dancing since people have existed. So, you know, from the caveman dancing around the flame and drumming, you know, and just like this little group of cavemen when man was nomadic to now. That's kind of why the circuit parties are really fun, because it's the same. It's in our muscle memory, it's in our DNA, this dancing together at a communal sort of thing, and we all feel good at the same time, and we love this one song. It's a powerful feeling, and I think it's like we know, you know, we know that feeling, we like that feeling. You know, it takes us off of all the other stuff that's going on in the world, and you can have fun with your friends and dance, you know? But Terrace Pensacola is so much fun because you have all these like dedicated clubbers and their friends, and it's outside. You have the beautiful vista of the Montreal skyline. I can't ask for anything more. It's outside in the fresh air. I mean, this and Picnic Electronique are my choice events for the summer. Because it's enough to be in a dark club, you know? Like if you want to go dancing and listen to music, this is outside. And they always have great DJs like Angel Moraes. I love him. You know, so for sure I'm going tomorrow. Tomorrow's the official closing party, the official after party to my birthday, so of course I'm going to be there. When Facebook first came out, I remember I was doing marketing for Mado Lamotte's play, and the producer of the play, Mark Waddy, was telling me, like, oh, it's the age of Facebook, go for it, girl. You know, and I was like, I don't want to have anything to do with this Facebook. I was so, just like when texting came out, because I didn't know how to do it, I was a naysayer, you know? And then, you know, slowly but surely, I watched everybody doing it, and finally, Kat went on the bandwagon. And when I joined Facebook, I'm telling you, it's like mushrooms.
little by little, I just started making more friends and contacts. And it's, I'm telling you, all the artists listening right now, it's the kick-ass way to go to get promoted, to get promotion, to reach new people internationally, to find out about what other people are doing, to look at people's pictures, albums, to share pictures, albums. Like, it's a wonderful communicating tool. I love it. I'm just nervous about one thing. If it ever goes down and disappears, how am I going to save all my contacts? Like, I don't know how to, I don't know how to download all those. And because you know what I'm realizing, what's really fun about Facebook is people are on it all the time because they have it connected to their cells and stuff, or they're at home, they're on their computer. So it's really, everyone's interested in what's going on. And when there's some kind of drama or something going on and there's like real heat around an event or something, people comment and it becomes very spontaneous, and you really want to know what's going on, and you're looking to see who commented. And I think there's like a momentum, a virtual momentum that it kind of builds, and it's wonderful. I want to develop my protege mentor concept that I started doing. Because right now I'm working with three young painters and they're kick-ass. They're all in their 20s, they're amazing, but they don't know how it works. And I remember when I was a young painter and totally unknown, even pre-emerging, you know, like when I didn't know like how I was gonna do anything, I just had a kick-ass business card. I used to go all over the place, like New York City and wherever I went, to clubs and dancing, I'd give out my card like crazy, you know, like a loser, you know, but not a loser, it was good. Like telling people like, hey, I paint, do you buy art? You know, like anyone I'd meet. And then little by little, obviously learning things as I went along in event production and stuff, I learned how to negotiate public relations and work with the media and you know, do all this kind of stuff. Now I'm teaching these young artists how to do it. And I'm having so much fun. And especially when I see that they have promise and they're really good, then it's my pleasure to do it. Because it wasn't always easy for me. Like when I was young, I used to meet established artists. Excuse me. And I always thought, oh my God, this is it. This is my big break. I just met so-and-so, they're gonna help me, they're gonna take me under their wing, I'll become famous, blah, blah, blah. And 9 times out of 10, they were like pushing me away because they didn't wanna have a new, fresh, young talent possibly stealing their light. And all these years later, now that I'm established, I know how it works, I know how to do it, I don't wanna be like that. And I don't wanna be like more normal agents and galleries whereby they control the artist, you know, they don't let them know who bought their art. They don't give them any contact information. They keep everything kind of separate, hidden, secret. I see that happening in the gallery world all the time. What I do with my artists is, let's say I just launched an exclusive preview for a young artist. Her name is Laurence Narbonne. Amazing artist, she's 24, she paints like Goya, you know? It's like, whoever I bring to her that's a contact, a new contact, her job, her homework, is to build a database in Outlook and list this person under the database where she's supposed to list it. Either it's a sponsor, either it's a buyer, potential client, a lead. So I'm teaching her to collect contacts and showing her, okay, you gotta have your database ready. You know, in 5-10 years, she's gonna have all her media, she's gonna have all her clients, she's gonna have hopefully hundreds of lists of people that are gonna be key contacts for her. These are things that every artist needs to know. You need to have your databases organized, you know, so you can have data on your clients. Who are they? What did they buy? When is their birthday? Did they get a thank you note? Did they get a little note from you? When was the last time you spoke to them? Do you send out a newsletter? Like, how do you keep in touch? Because otherwise, it just becomes crazy, and you got to keep that contact with your customers, because they buy it. You know, so I'm teaching my young little proteges how to do all that stuff, and I love it. I want to always do my special events. One big part of me will always raise money for needy charities and focusing on HIV prevention. I want to continue educating about HIV, because like I said, I consider myself totally lucky that I didn't get it. So that's my main focus too, is to just really continue doing that. I'm going younger, I'm going to focus younger, like on people who are in their 20s now, who will be having children soon. So I want to teach them to teach their kids about prevention and HIV. And I want to develop my proteges. And I don't know how I'll do it, probably like a talent, kind of like a talent agency or something. You know, I just want to keep it, kind of expand on what I'm doing right now and just search out for new artists and then launch them, you know, help them do shows, help build them up. So much fun, because you know, there's new ones popping up every day, I'm sure you know, right? I haven't been up there at all. No, the whole time was crazy during Jazz Festival. We were crazy with work with Carnot that we didn't even have time to do anything except for work on the gallery, because we had our biggest vernissage for her ever. We had over 350 people that week during the Jazz Festival, because it made such an impact that they chose her to be the artist of the year. That was very good for her. Well, we basically approached them. We basically approached them and said, listen, here's an artist who comes from a small town in Quebec. when she was a huge star in Montreal, she left it all to go breakthrough internationally in New York, you know, in 20 years ago when it wasn't so easy. She did it. She did it all on her own accord with her own hard-headedness and her strength. We really pushed the fact that this girl is where she is right now due to hard work, determination, focus. She's a testament to that, and it's fun. And I love showing that to young artists because that's a great story to give them the hope that they can do it too, because more often than not, we just hear the bad stories. This guy was starving, this guy never sold, this guy cut his ear, hello, you know? So it's like, this is a good story. And we approach the jazz with that in mind, like, look, it's her 30th anniversary in the painting business, it's your 30th, don't you think we could make... And they jumped on the idea, they thought, wonderful. And so they commissioned her to do a big painting. She did, 5 by 6 foot. And then we authorized the... You saw the original? It's nice, eh? Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah. Cheers. Thank you.
No problem.
Appreciate it big time.
My pleasure.
I love it. Well, I've known Corno's art for at least 20 years. I followed her art and more. I love her art, but I love her story more than anything. And I used to always approach her all the time when I was with BBCM and offer her the chance to come and offer us the chance to have her in our show. And so many times it didn't work because she was too busy or, you know, she was traveling and it never happened. Finally, when she came, she did a black and blue when Cirque du Soleil was given the artistic direction that year, and she donated 4 huge canvases that they were sold and money was raised for BBCM. I got to meet her finally that year. That was 2003. From that day on, she said, anytime you're in New York, call me, let's have lunch. For sure, like clockwork. I was in New York like 2 months later, ding dong, I'm here. And I took the chance, you know, and I just wanted to... Here was an artist that I considered amazing and like, wow. And here she was offering me the chance, telling me, call me when you're in New York, let's have lunch. Let's have coffee. I would be crazy not to do it. So we got to know each other like that with my trips to New York. And then, you know, slowly but surely, I put her on my mailing list. So she started to see over the years what I've been doing. And, you know, I was approached by the gallery director of AK Gallery because they wanted somebody who was with my sort of expertise and dynamics and who liked Corno, who was a fan and was able to, because be careful, you can't sell what you don't like. You can't lie to customers. You know, so they wanted somebody who was like familiar enough with the art and the artist who believed in that art to come and help push the gallery along. And that's what I did. So my title is Director of Development. My job is to increase her promotion, increase her prices, increase her visibility, sell her art. So what I'm doing right now is I'm just, you know, the Jazz Fest is one big hurdle we just passed. Now I'm just, you know, looking at other venues where we can place Corno and keep her always whispering in the ears of the Quebecers, you know? So that, I love it. It's so much fun. It's like a dream job, you know, to be able to... And I love explaining her legend and her story to customers. You have to come to the gallery so I can, like, give you the tour, you know, the official tour. But when I'm there, I have to give you the cat tour. Okay, good. It's a story. It's the fact that she was, you know, when she first started out, she was totally criticized because people were saying, like, what is this art? You know, it's not politically motivated, not social, it's just pretty. She's just painting beautiful faces and bodies. Like, who cares? It's so two-dimensional. But she likes doing that. And she always wanted to do that. And that's what comes out of her subconscious and these faces and these bodies. And be careful, when you look at her art, I've analyzed her art, it's really a reinterpretation of a classical theme, the torso and the face. We've been painting that forever. But the way she does it, she balances between classical and modern because she always does like these gestural abstracts, like with the hair. And it's like a tender balance between realism. You could tell this painter obviously knows how to paint realistically. But it's the way she's developed this sort of style and this signature of hers. Large scale, very bold, lots of impasto, amazing colors. Her paintings, like people don't realize this, but there's a study. She like spends time studying which colors she's going to use. And she ends up making these color combinations. She's a colorist, like amazing colorist. So if you look at her paintings, she ends up putting together these colors that the average person would like never think this would work, but it works. You know, so she's developed this sort of technique. She calls herself an urban expressionist. There's an aspect of tagging in her works because she'll like just throw paint. When she's done, she'll do a beautiful realistic portrait and then she'll whip paint all over it. And it's like a young artist would never dare do that because you just finished working, I don't know how many hundreds of hours, finishing the patina on this face that's like perfect, and then you're gonna throw paint on it. So she's almost destroying the painting at the end, you know, like, and she's daring to like, you know, just dare every time to do something. And she's becoming more abstract and she's getting bigger. And it's like, I just like, there's two sides to the Corno story. It's the story, like the legend, how she got to where she is by never listening. And what I love is all those people that criticized her when she went to New York, they were like, she'll be back. You know, and like, yeah, she's not gonna last. Well, hello, 30 years in the business later, every other day I meet young painters that wanna be little Corneaus now, you know, and they paint like Corno, the same style, the same scale, they name Corno as their master. That's pretty damn good. You know, so she's influenced, this little girl from Chicoutimi has influenced a generation of young painters now, you know, who wanna be like her. You know, so that's wonderful. It's just, I think she's more important to Quebec art history and culture than we know. And you know, she's pierced internationally, so has the Cirque du Soleil, so has Céline Dion, so has Luc Plamondon, so has Bombardier. But you know what I mean? It's someone who's alive and famous while she's alive, and she's still young, so she's going for it, you know? It's that story that we all want. That story as a young artist that you want. You want to have that story, but okay, so you don't have it right now, but you can dream. Look how Corno did it. Maybe that'll rub off on you a little bit. So it's that, it's almost like Hollywood. You know, like she did it. How cool is that? So her success is the pride of all Quebecers and Canadians, I find. And you know, people will always, the purists, and there are certain people, because I've approached certain collectors who do not think this art merits to be in their collection because they'll only collect Group of Seven, or they'll only collect people coming out of Le Refus Global. You know, and they don't think that she's worth it because she's, they call her commercial, you know, because she makes money and she sells. Well, how else is she gonna butter her bread? What is it with people saying that if you make money as an artist, you're commercial, you don't count, it doesn't mean anything? I disagree. I think more power to them. That's her job, that's her vocation. Let her make money, let her be successful. We can proudly say she's represented on three continents now. You know, like, that's pretty good. You know, so I think the story, okay, I love the art, but the story more than anything is what I love, because it's a good story and it's a true story. And so she wasn't put there because Gagosian or Saatchi bought her art. You know, she was put there because she put herself there, and I like that. Okay. That's what I like. I like her determination, her guts, okay. You know? Oh, really? I like her already. Oh, there's going to be a party for that when that happens, for sure. What I do is I realize that I have divisions in my art, and I realize that certain divisions of my art, they're like, some of my art that I do has to do only with really heavy duty problems, you know, like HIV, drug addiction, drug abuse, gay and lesbian rights and stuff like that. And this kind of stuff is very popular with a certain niche market. And it's not really the kind of stuff that sells very well because the stuff is really heavy duty and sometimes it's pretty crude. And it's not the kind of stuff people want to be reminded of and put on their walls, but I'm conscious that this is the kind of stuff that will eventually be sold to museums because it's like really important art that talks about problems. Then I have another division that's very abstract art that I do, which are these very three-dimensional tubes in different colors that really move on the canvas. This is the art that I sell a lot of, and this goes into people's collections, and people love this kind of stuff because it's super original. Then I have a third division where I do pop art portraits, which also sells really well. People like that, you know, and I do fun portraits, like I've done Wallace Simpson, and I do characters I like. And then I do my special events, and I also started mentoring artists. So I have three young painters that are working with me, and I'm helping them to show them the ropes and how it works. So I kind of like just, kind of like a jack of all trades. I do everything but like, you know, electricity and welding, basically. The tube stuff I always did as a kid, I used to doodle like that, and my teachers in school loved it, and they always used to tell me, like, do it in color, but I had a black period, like a dark period when I was young, and I never wanted to do those in color, and then as I developed it, first one I did in colors was in oils in 93, and it really came out good. People really liked it, so then I just started developing, expanding, and now I make them into puzzles, like 6 or 7 in a row, as much as 10 in a row. They join, they add, they subtract, they can be put together, like pattern making, into different shapes, and you can move them around, they make a totally different painting. So that just kind of developed over the years, and the pop portraits, it developed at the same time. I was just always doing them, because I always used to draw faces and bodies, and like, you know, all the time, so then I just started painting them. And I, you know, it was just something that I can do, so I figured, why not? You know, like the tubes I'm doing, it's really coming from my subconscious. Yeah, but different sizes. Some sizes are like 30 by 30, like square. Some are rectangular. Different sizes. They kind of go like, if you picture like a plate of spaghetti noodles, and each noodle is a different color, and they're all intertwining. And look on my Facebook, the albums are there. And what happens is, it's a study in color theory, and line and shading and light. So it's all, it applies all the principles of drawing and painting, but with theory, color theory behind it. So it's a way for the artist to transmit energy to the viewer, because what happens is the painting becomes very organic because it's always moving, it's in constant flux, and there's a tension that develops because I'm purposely putting certain colors together next to each other that creates another energy. So when you see the painting, it looks like it's moving to your eyes, but your eyes seem to follow it, and it's very interesting. It looks great in a very clinical setting because it's so organic, and I love to use like primary, secondary colors and really good pigments. So I invest a lot into the good quality paint to make these paintings really luscious, you know, like the color looks really great.
And these are in
oil? Oil and acrylic.
Oil and acrylic?
Yes. Acrylics, oils, sometimes mixed media, because sometimes I'll include different objects on them. I'll put different stuff like clippings, letters, writing, whatever I want, you know, but mostly they're acrylic actually. Yeah. No, it's not even painting a portrait, it's just portraits of characters or just painting figures, you know, like faces, bodies, pop art, you know, like really just lots of bright color once again. Color's really important to me, like if it doesn't have a good color, I don't care who did it, I'm not going to look again. I'll give you an example. I just did a portrait of Harper, and it's called Pack Your Bags, Harper, and I kind of made him look like Adolf Hitler a little bit, slightly, and then I took two of these little small plastic baggies, like small tiny ones, and I typed up, Pack Your Bags, Harper, and I put it under his eyes, and it's like, Pack Your Bags, Harper. Okay. So it's like, sometimes there's a joke or a play on words. There's a lot of, I use a lot of irony in my art, you know, like, and like satire, I love that. Because I like to make people, when they first see it, they're not sure what it is, then they have to look at it, think about it for a while, and they get it, you know, and then hopefully they like it. But the average person doesn't know that they have an art collection, and it's a wonderful collection that has all the great masters of Quebec, including the young masters, like, which I count the young masters, like Zilon, like Corneau now. And I think what... No, but you know, I consider Zilon a young master, because I don't consider him a master, like an old master. I still consider Zilon to be timeless. I think it's wonderful, and once that permanent gallery opens up, the public will be able to go look at it, and what a great collection to showcase, you know? So I'm interested and curious to see how this gallery will look on the second floor in that building. You know, I'm sure it's going to be great. You know what? These things where they put art outside, like even the Festival International d'Art de Montréal, that's in the village, the Festival des Arts, this kind of stuff is great. You know why? Because most people, and I'm counting myself, we don't like the clinical aspect of a gallery or a museum most times. Because a lot of times, except at AKA where I work, you walk into gallery or museum and it's very like hush hush, you're not allowed to talk, you can't ask questions, you can't even do anything, you have to just look and walk and leave. And art is meant for sharing, and art is supposed to be fun. So it's like when I get people at AK Gallery that come in, the first thing we do is we say hello, when like we mean it, you know, and we let them look at the art, and then we ask them right away, like, do you have any questions? Do you know this artist? We're here if you need us. And then we strike up a conversation 9 times out of 10 on purpose, because we want them to leave feeling like A, they learned something about this artist, B, they're going to tell their friends they're going to come back, C, that art can be fun. Because a lot of times people are scared if they're not like well read about art, you know, if they don't know about art history, they don't want to sound dumb by asking a silly question, which to them might sound silly, which to someone like you or me is just, okay, no problem, ask me anything about this painting, I'll explain to you. You know, so I find that by bringing art into the street sometimes, even like what the Célébration de la Fierté did last weekend, we had a Café des Arts where myself and Yvonne Goulet exhibited outside. The best experience ever. Spend 3 days outside, hundreds of people coming at you every day, asking you about your art, looking at your art. You can watch them as they look at your art, and it's more of a fun setting. So it's like bringing the museum or the gallery into the street makes it a bit more rough. It's less pristine and whatever, but it makes it more fun. And then people like it, and that's what we need. We need more people to like it, because it's not just for purists. Art should be for everybody, and it's made for everybody. So why keep it separate? You know, I never liked that clinical aspect of galleries or museums, and I hate being treated like that. Sometimes when I go in a gallery, and they just look at me, and they go, oh, she's not going to buy anything. How would you know? You know, I happen to collect art, but you know, what if I'm dressed like a bum that day? Oh, I hate that. You know, so it's all about customer service and being nice and like encouraging people to ask, and maybe they'll come back, maybe they'll buy. But more importantly, they're going to like it and they're going to talk about it. And that's what you want. You want to spread the news. You know, I want to share the wealth. You know? Cheers.
Thank you. No problem.
Appreciate it big time.
My pleasure.
I love it. I always knew I was good at art. From when I was 2 years old, I could draw anything. Like, I mean, I could draw anything from memory. I don't even have to look at it. But I always struggled with what am I going to be? How is it going to happen for me? Like, I remember one time I had this panic attack. I was like 10 years old. All my friends were like, I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be this. And I was like, what the hell am I going to be? And it really took actually the last 15 years of trying to figure it out. Until I finally figured it out and used different experiences that I had of different jobs, and in those jobs I count every single job I had as a major learning experience to help me do what I do today, like waitressing that I did for 10 years while I was going to university, and a special events production that I did, which enables me now to be independent and just produce, pay, create, execute my events from A to Z, which is amazing. But the whole thing kind of started when I took my first HIV test in 94. Because I thought I was HIV positive, like a lot of my friends, and I had met friends who had HIV and people I knew had HIV in those years. And like a lot of people, I was scared to take the test. When I finally took the test, found that I was negative, that was a milestone year for me. And then I joined BBCM as a volunteer, Bad Boy Club Montreal, and I wanted to bring the art into the circuit party. And that's when it kind of all spearheaded, because I was given a chance by BBCM to produce their first annual art exhibition auction. That happened in 96, created a show called Hope, Espoir. And we wanted to just bring together, the point was to bring together artists from all different walks of life under one umbrella, which was AIDS fundraising and awareness and prevention education, and get them to use their art to spread this message. And from then on, BBCM really liked what I did and they hired me, and I ended up working for them for 5 years straight. And I created annual exhibitions and auctions, and that's when I started to get to know artists, and I started to learn how to produce and how to raise money and how to do sponsorship proposals. And when I finally left BBCM in 2003, I was totally independent, like I knew how to do it. And I think the fact that I learned how to do HIV fundraising and I got to know the whole community because I was working with the LGBTQ community, then I realized, like, oh my God, I could use my art to further education, because I started to think it's so important to promote HIV prevention, because I don't think it's done enough. And there's so many things I could talk to you about how young people don't care today, you know? So I found a way to use my art as a communicating tool to raise money for different HIV charities, to raise awareness, and to promote different ideas about health. There's always that risk, you know, when you're edgy and subversive, you know, you never know. I might get a call from the Vatican one of these days, you know? I'll be ready. I do art that talks about HIV prevention, drug addiction, drug abuse, LGBT rights. Like, I feel like a lot of my art deals with that stuff. Because when I started to get to know LGBT people, LGBTQT, there's so many different letters we can add, and I love it, you know? I just realized that these poor people were being given, like, the short end of the stick, you know? And I didn't really have any experience with gay people before then. I mean, I knew they existed, but I didn't really care about them. When I found out, when I started to meet them, and when I was accepted, kind of, because there wasn't that many women like 15 years ago working in the gay community, but they kind of liked me because I was kind of still punk. So I kind of looked like one of the boys, you know, I had my wallet with the chain and my Doc Martens and my spiky bracelets and stuff. So I wasn't like, you know, a girly girl coming in trying to like cruise gay guys. I was just like there to dance and have fun. And meanwhile, at the same time, I was standing up for them without even knowing it by doing my HIV prevention stuff, because I felt like such a strong urge and need to talk about HIV. But then I really diverted that into LGBT rights, because then I saw how people could be so like homophobic and abusive and negative, and you know, basing their judgments on being uneducated and from fear and from all this crap. And at least we have it good in Quebec, you know, but still, there's a lot of little kids still being called faggot in school. There's a lot of people who still could open their minds and their hearts, you know, and it just came naturally, the rebel in me. I always hated, like, it goes back to being a kid, you know, in the West Island. It's like, I always wanted to be the black sheep, and I liked it. I didn't want to be like everybody else, and everybody, even my parents when I was young, were trying to make me be like everybody else and conform, and I'm the most anti-conformist person you're ever going to meet, because if it's in style, I don't want to wear it. So in a way, it's like, with gay rights and that, it's just, nothing pleases me more than to debate somebody who's totally diabolically opposed to what I believe in, and especially when I know in my heart and soul that, you know, that's wrong. You know, just give this person a chance. My grandmother used to say, five fingers on the hand, each one is different. And I took that today to mean, like, you know, everybody's different. We all come from the same tree, you know? So it's like the world should be giving gay guys another finger, you know? Maybe the thumb, you know, and not the middle finger. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, just, it came naturally to me to be a supporter of these people because I felt like I had to. It's like I had to do it. It was just a natural calling, and it just kind of developed as I was working with BBCM and as I was meeting all these people, and they accepted me as one of the boys. They accepted me in the fold, and I go out and I go dancing with them, and they love my ideas and they think I'm great. And what happens is it's a really nice exchange with the gay community because they feed my ego like there's no tomorrow. So you have all these people telling you like, that was great, or we really like that show, or you know, don't forget artists, we spend 95% of our time alone in the studio by ourselves creating, and a lot of times we go through all kinds of craziness. We're more sensitive than others. We create art because of these pains we feel and we process. And then when you go out and you get the reaction from the crowd, you know, and they give you good or bad, whatever it is, it just makes you want to go even more, you know? So it's like a give and take that I have with the community, and I just love it. You know, and I have so much fun with them, and then I've been raising money for different AIDS charities, and at the same time, that makes them happy. I'm always conscious of, like, whatever I do, I try to make it a very much like a team effort, because I know that it's better. In Montreal, there's quite a lot of people, because a lot of Croatians left Croatia in the 70s, during, you know, the reign of Tito and communism, and if they weren't part of the Communist Party, they just decided. Like my dad, was a ship captain, sailed around the world, he saw Canada, loved it, and he's so much into Libertas, which is like the slogan of our city, Dubrovnik, freedom, freedom for all. And he's like a total freedom-loving person, a person who likes justice, and there was none at the time. And you know, until 91, when Croatia declared independence, and then the whole thing changed. But a lot of smart people left, you know, and there's more Croatians in the diaspora than there are in Croatia, they say. Really?
Yes.
I wouldn't know, you know? I know a lot of Croatians, but I don't know any Croatian artists. I moved here in 73. I was 3 years old. Talk about culture shock. I grew up in the West Island. I went to PCHS and Pierrefonds Comprehensive High School. But I don't know. And then for college, I went to Vanier, where I had the best education of my life because I did multidisciplinary arts. And then from then on, I went to Concordia, where I did my Bachelor of Fine Arts with double minor archaeology, art history. But I've always kind of gravitated towards downtown. In West Island at the time, when I was growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, I didn't fit in at all. It was so preppy, and I was such a rebel. Like, I was into the Sex Pistols and PIL and all this stuff, punk. And let's just say it was fun to just go downtown and avoid, you know, Cheers and those types of bars and stuff like that, where I found more fun and more excitement and multiculturalism, you know. The West Island was so white bread. And if you didn't fit in, it was just bad, you know, you just gotta go somewhere else. So I was always waiting, I couldn't wait. All my friends went to John Abbott, I couldn't wait to get out and go to some other college. In a perfect world, that's how you'd like it to be, super organized, where you divide your schedule and try to be, you know, but it's never like that. Because sometimes, you know, you'll have so much work where you have to do everything all the time and you have to be on and available and your cell phone doesn't go off and you're just working like crazy. And like most artists, other times there's a lull. That's those times when you're questioning yourself, like, do I suck? You know, and you have like, you could have a month or two or more with no contracts, nothing going on. In those dead times, you're obviously trying to scrounge and look for new contacts. So when I have the dead times, I'm trying to actively search for new contracts. So I'm creatively thinking of new ideas for projects, writing them up, sending them out, pitching ideas. But it's hard to When I have a few big contracts all at once, yeah, definitely have to organize my schedule and divide my time. I also work part-time in a gallery. I am the director for Corno. Yeah, that's a dream job that I got a year ago. So that's part of my week, 20 hours a week. And then the other, I must work more than 40 hours a week for sure. So the other, let's say even 40 hours a week, I'm sort of rotating, sometimes in the studio, other times administering. Because, you know, artists, we have to be like jugglers. You have to produce, you have to create, you have to administer, you have to promote. Logistics, like there's always stuff to go. And I'm not at the position where I can hire my own publicist. So I do it all myself. I have an assistant and a translator that work for me when it's busy season. But otherwise, I could do it all, you know, and I just rotate my files. I'm very conscious of my public perception and how I want to, like, create my persona in the public eye to make it, like, better for me in the long term, for longevity. You know, I'm known now by the people in my age group. Now I'm going younger. You know, I'm constantly recruiting, like, younger fans. Who's going to be the cat fan in 5-10 years from now? You know, so it's really fun. I love my life right now. After 15 years, I figured it out.
Okay.
And it's starting to happen, and I'm starting to work, and people are coming to me and asking, you know, like, for help, and I'm getting more contracts, so it's all good. No complaints from the cat factory right now. I'm a very private person, and when I do have my downtime, and I have, you know, I know lots of people know me, but I do have a very public, very private side that I just keep to myself and do my thing. But a lot of my public side has to do with my business, so it's good to be in the public, you know. So of course, with my birthday party, I was turning 40, and I've already produced parties for friends in the past where they had milestone birthdays and we raised money for a good cause. So of course, people were expecting something, so I had to do it for my birthday, you know. I had to do it, so I did. My private side is when I'm at home with my Akita and I take him up the mountain, and it's just me and him, me and Sumo, and we go for our one big 2-hour walk every morning, you know. That's my private time, where I just live in the moment. And I don't even think of any projects or anything, and I just think of how nice it is to walk my dog. You know what I mean? And like, my private side is when I go to bed at night and I go to sleep and I had a full day and that's it. You know, the rest of the time when I'm working, I'm always on. So even if I'm working for Corno 20 hours a week, I'm always on for Corno. You know, it's like automatic. When it's time to go on vacation, I'm gonna take a week off this winter. I'm gonna go to Puerto Vallarta with my assistant Gil. It's gonna be downtime. I'm not gonna do anything. I'm just gonna relax and get a tan. When I go to Croatia in the summer, you know, that's a downtime. Last summer was a big show for me there, but you know, that's a downtime. Otherwise, I don't have time to waste and have a downtime. I need to promote, I need to work, I need to get more contracts, I need to get more known, I need to sell more art.
Okay.
So time's ticking, no? It's the business, because the business is me, you know? So it's all about what I love to do, and it's such a big part of me, it's who I am. So if the boyfriend comes along while I'm doing this and it's within that context, that's fine, but it's not a priority right now. You know, I'm really just concentrated on my art. Yeah, it's just how it is, and I am what you see, you know, and I am what I do. So it's like, you are what you do, and everything I've done has become my career, you know, and like my history, you know. By I built up on all these little events and stuff bit by bit, so that's me, you know. So I am what you see, you know.
Exactly.
Like
it's way easier now.
Exactly. It's just real, you know. It's just do it, you know. It's good to be us. That's my latest slogan, you know. It's good to be us. And you know, walk my dog. And my friend at Conciergerie is having a little special get-together for me, so I'm going to go there at 8. I'm going to eat something, you know, okay. Take it easy. Party will be till 3, then I'm going to go home at 3 and go to sleep. Yeah, I'm old now, you know? I'm going to have my early bird dinner at 4:30. You know?
I'm working.
I like it. You know what? I always say this. I'm like, I'm turning 40, got the experience of 80. I still look like 20 in good light. You know, it's like, who cares? It's just chronology. Man invented this. Rising, setting of the sun, equals a day, equals a year, is our chronological calendar. It really depends on how you lived your life, because how many 40-year-olds do you know that are still dumb like 18? And how many 60-year-olds do you know that are like smarter than their years? So I think it depends on how you lived your life, what you absorbed, what you learned, how open you are to learning, because you got to learn in order for yourself to grow. So it's like, I'm always young at heart, I'm always joking, laughing. I'm laughing at myself, number one. So I stayed like young at heart and young. So it's like, I when people say like, oh, I'm turning 40, and they're like so disgusted, I just laugh it off. I'm like, who cares, you know? How do you feel?
Mm-hmm. You know? The fact that as I get older, I know more.
You know more. And you age gracefully, you know? And you have like, we should be more like the Japanese, and we should revere turning older, you know, and like respect it. But we have a society where we're just focused on youth, and you need a potion, a pill, a cream to be young, you know, and we don't want to grow old so we dye our hair and we get all this stupid treatment, you know, like, who cares, you know? I want to gracefully age, you know?